I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology in which nobody understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
You're listening to Talking Biotech, the weekly podcast illuminating issues in agriculture and medical biotechnology. Your questions and concerns are answered using a science-based approach with the goal of driving innovation to application with communication. Now here's your host, Dr. Paul Vincelli.
Welcome to the Talking Biotech podcast, the weekly podcast where we discuss contemporary issues in science and technology with a focus on biotechnology and new innovations that can help people and the planet. I'm Paul Vincelli, sitting in for Dr. Kevin Folta, and today we'll be talking about forest restoration and the role of biotechnology in that. Today we'll be speaking with Ellen Crocker. She's a postdoctoral scholar and works in the Department of Forestry here at the University of Kentucky, and has a particular interest in forest health issues. So welcome, Ellen. Glad to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me on the podcast.
Well, we have a lot of interest, of course, in forests and forest health. But before we move into that area, there are several topics that I wanted to touch on in your background. And first, maybe you could give us a bit of an explanation as to your professional interests, maybe even a little bit about why you became a plant pathologist and a tree expert, basically.
Sure. So I have a PhD in plant pathology. All of my dissertation work was actually working with invasive species in a marsh wetland context, trying to figure out why they're invasive, to better manage them. They're a serious problem all over in a bunch of different ecosystem types, including forests. So that's what I did for my dissertation work. But my interest in plant pathology comes from my work between undergraduate and graduate studies working with sudden oak death. So for anyone who's not familiar with sudden oak death, it's a oomycete disease that's wiping out oaks on the West Coast. I worked with UC Berkeley, the Garbolato Lab at UC Berkeley, looking at that disease and also doing some extension work surrounding communicating what's going on and what are some steps that people can be taking to manage it. So that's where my interest in all of this comes from. Right now, I'm working with the Forest Health Research and Education Center located at the University of Kentucky. It's a collaboration between the University of Kentucky's Department of Forestry and the U.S. Forest Service, as well as the Kentucky Division of Forestry. So the idea of this center is to bring together researchers in biological sciences as well as social sciences and education and outreach specialists to increase the sustainability of the eastern forests. So trying to find genetics-based tools as well as economic resources to foster that and build forest restoration.
Yeah. So in fact, we worked together on one or two projects, Ellen, and so we're certainly pleased to have you as part of our team here at the University of Kentucky's College of Agriculture, Food, and Environment. So, in fact, one of the projects we're working on is Ag Biotech Day. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about what's coming here in a few months?
Definitely. I'm really excited about it. Our idea going into this is that a lot of people don't know what biotechnology is, and they don't know how it's being applied. People have heard some buzzwords, might have read some things online, but the general public just doesn't know what's happening even here in Lexington, at Lexington, Kentucky, at our own university. So our idea was to bring high school students to campus and have them tour labs and learn from the graduate students and postdoctoral scholars in those laboratories. What are they doing? Why is it important? And how does it affect a bigger frame of things? So we will have, I think we're going to cap it around 75 students coming to the University of Kentucky. The plant sciences, plant pathology, entomology departments have labs who've decided to open up and invite students in to see their work. And my hope is that it will just give students a totally different perspective, give them a chance to ask questions and have them answered by specialists in those areas, and also open up some eyes to potential future career opportunities and paths of study at the university.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we, in our initial planning, I know one of the sort of the foci of this whole effort of Ag Biotech Day was to sort of humanize biotechnology. There can be a lot of dissension and even unpleasant debate in the social media. And I know that, you know, you and I see it, biotechnology, not in that way at all, but more as a set of tools that can help us do good things. And so we thought it would be important to humanize biotechnology for young people, where they could just go and meet real, you know, graduate students similar to their own age, not just a few years older, and see some of the excitement and learn something about the projects that that are taking place at UK. So yeah, I'm excited too. You also have been involved in another initiative that I knew very little about until I prepared for this podcast. You were one of the hosts for the STEM conference for middle school girls that occurred just a couple days ago. Is that right?
Yes, it was fantastic. This is called the Expanding Your Horizons Conference. So probably some of the listeners from different parts of the country and maybe even the world have participated in one previously. So Expanding Your Horizons is an international network of hands-on STEM conferences for middle school girls. So the whole idea is to middle school is an age at which a lot of young women kind of lose interest in science. And obviously there's not enough women in a lot of the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics fields at a higher level. So the question is, how do you increase retention? How do you keep science interesting and engaging for young women at that age especially? So these Expanding Your Horizons conferences have been had all over the U.S. at 38 different states and several countries, but this is the first one that we've had in Kentucky. So myself, Dr. Susan Odom, and Dr. Bradford Condon got an NSF EBSCOR grant to host one here. And the really cool thing about this conference, and why one of the reasons I was excited to do it, is that not only do these middle school girls have this day of hands-on, inquiry-based workshops, but those workshops are led by UK students, so undergraduates and graduate students, that throughout the semester had been working with me, as well as their faculty mentors, to come up with different workshops that would test a hypothesis or solve a problem, so that the young women who attended would get some window into what it was like actually doing science. So not just the kind of learning process, but how do you test a hypothesis? And be exposed to all of these UK students who are just a little bit older than them, but really relatable. So they can ask them questions they might have about what's college like, how do they need to prepare, and just shift some of their mental images of what scientists look like by providing those role models. So this past weekend, we had about 120 girls from all over Kentucky that came here, including one group of about 40 students that had to drive 4 hours to get here from the western part of the state. And we had about 50 UK students leading these workshops, as well as another 50 or so volunteers that walked around with the groups of girls all day, helped them feel comfortable on campus.
Yeah. Well, you should certainly be very proud. You all have initiated that effort. Yeah, in fact, scientific societies, at least in the realm of biology, are certainly paying attention to gender issues in the field of science. I know in my own society, our own society of the American Phytopathological Society, there's sort of an awareness of the attrition that takes place between graduate school and the professional level professors and other professional plant pathologists, where the numbers of females or the percentage of females typically seems to go down somewhat. And so I think it's an issue that many of us in scientific societies are paying attention to, and it's wonderful to provide these really positive role models for young women at these early ages. So congratulations to you for doing that.
Well, thank you. It was a great experience. I think we tried to emphasize the role models to the young women who came, as well as the fact that, we have major problems out there in the world. And if we want to solve them, we want to have the best of everyone, regardless of what gender or race, ethnicity someone is. We need everyone, the best minds, to reach those solutions.
Yeah. Good attitude. So let's talk about biotechnologies. I know your principal interest is really more in conservation and forest restoration. So give us an introduction into the relationship of biotechnology to forest restoration and conservation in general.
Well, I think forestry and forest science is on the threshold of a major change when it comes to biotechnology, especially with regard to tree breeding, but also in other ways. So there, as in any field, there are many different ways in which this new molecular toolbox is being used and reasons for why it's being used. I think when people hear about biotechnology, the first thing that comes to mind is genetic engineering in the context of industry use by large agricultural companies. But forest restoration is a totally different area where biotechnology is increasingly becoming important. So this is being driven by ecological as well as sometimes economic goals, but it typically doesn't come from industry. So it's a lot of universities and nonprofit organizations that are leading the charge to use these tools to increase the sustainability of particular tree species, as well as forests in general. So this could be in response to invasive threats, insects and diseases that are wiping out trees, and using biotechnology to breed trees that are resistant or stop some of those threats. It can also be just better understanding the trees that are present, the diversity of forests, and how they're interacting with different components of that ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, I'm definitely interested in the invasive threats. We'll table that for just a minute. Because I want to drill down a bit on that, but I'm interested in better understanding of the forest ecosystem itself. Give us an example of a way that you can achieve a better understanding of a forest ecosystem through a biotechnology tool?
Well, I think one of the ways that's happening is that we're learning more about the genetic diversity of forests. So before, pretty recently, there wasn't a lot of genetic work done on trees. And part of that is that those genomes are hard to work with, or those trees are hard to work with from a genetics perspective. So a lot of the new tools are giving scientists the ability to learn about the diversity that's present and how trees are responding to stresses that are out there. How do they respond to environmental stresses like drought, like salinity? And how can those be used to breed trees that are better at dealing with those problems? Similarly, how do trees naturally respond to diseases and insects? Trees that are resistant, why is that? And how can we use that information to breed trees that are more resistant to some of the invasive threats that we've got coming in?
So you, one of the things that we share together is, you're journal club, the one that you've organized here on campus for forest health interests. One of the papers that you provided to us was a review that's entitled "The Bigger Toolbox: Biotechnology and Biodiversity Conservation." And some of the listeners may be interested in obtaining that. So that paper outlined a number of different ways that biotechnologies could be useful in you know, some rather insightful kinds of things. So for example, tell me, I'm outlining this, but asking you to react to it, Ellen. Mm-hmm. So for example, if we had a particular species of tree or plant that we wish to conserve that needed conservation attention, using a biotechnology tool might be able to help us determine how to best focus our conservation efforts so that we represent as much of the diversity of that species as possible. Is that one of the kinds of applications that the biotechnology Definitely. Would be helpful with?
Definitely. So I think conserving that diversity is part of it. So with forest trees, especially in a restoration context, you want to have a high diversity. So any approaches that would bottleneck that would be a big problem. So, for example, if you're trying to figure out how resilient a population is, if something were to come in. So, for example, here in Kentucky, we care a lot about white oak. White oak is used in bourbon barrels, as well as really important in timber and ecologically as a food source for wildlife. If we're trying to find out how resilient white oak would be if some invasive insect disease came in that could target it, we want to know how diverse white oak is. We want to know where that diversity is present and how we can protect that. And those are all things that the biotechnology toolbox is going to allow us to do.
Yeah, that's right. So, and you used a term that it's you know common in biology, bottleneck or genetic bottleneck. Mm-hmm. And so, I want to highlight that for the listeners because it's very descriptive. So, in other words, if we don't have a clear idea of the full range of genetic diversity in a species that we're interested in, if we don't understand that genetic diversity and because we can't see it, you know, with our eyes, then we might end up selecting white oaks or plants, other plants, to use in a conservation effort that represents just a mere bottleneck of what's out there. So I love that term bottleneck, and I was glad you used it. So we by using biotechnology tools, we can understand the full range of genetics that are out there, and more systematically include those in our conservation efforts.
And I think that brings up another point that a lot of our responses to things like chestnut blight, for those of you who don't know, American chestnut used to be one of the dominant trees in eastern forests until a disease, chestnut blight, came in at the kind of early 1900s and wiped it out. So now you won't see chestnuts in the forests, even though it used to be about a quarter of the trees because of this disease. So what we're doing is we're playing catch up with chestnut. We're trying to figure out, now that those trees are gone, how can we reintroduce them and what are ways to get resistant trees? But now that we have this toolbox, hopefully what we can do in the future is avoid epidemics like that from happening, or at least catch them much sooner so that we don't have to completely reintroduce something. We can preserve the diversity that's present as well.
Yeah, great. Yeah, that's a great lead-in. So we're going to continue on this theme, but let's take a short break. We're talking to Dr. Ellen Crocker from the University of Kentucky. She's a postdoctoral scholar and a dear colleague to as part of our team here at UK. And when we come back, we'll talk about invasive pests and pathogens and in forest trees and biotechnology.
Today, a note about auto wrecks, podcasts, and happy endings. A note to the Talking Biotech podcast comes from Jenny from Bemidji, Minnesota. She says that she was listening to the Talking Biotech podcast while driving late on a snow-covered country road. She hit a patch of black ice and ended up losing control of her vehicle, rolling and landing upside down. She was unable to call for help as she was unable to find her phone. But wherever it was, and continued to play the Talking Biotech podcast. She was trapped there for over an hour, cold but unharmed. Thank goodness for airbags. She wrote, "I closed my eyes and listened to the podcast. Kevin and Paul kept me company until help arrived." She was able to enjoy two complete episodes of the Talking Biotech podcast and said that the soothing messages of science made a desperate time much more pleasurable. Thank you for letting us know, Jenny, and proud to be your podcast Jaws of Life. Share your experiences or interests with us at talkingbiotech@gmail.com. And now, back to the podcast.
And we're back on the Talking Biotech podcast with Dr. Ellen Crocker from the University of Kentucky. She's a postdoctoral scholar and very knowledgeable about a broad range of topics relating to forest trees, forest health, restoration of trees. And so we're thrilled to have you here with us, Ellen. Thanks for joining us.
Thrilled to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So before the break, we were talking about chestnut blight, which is a classic and very unfortunate disease that has occurred here and wiped out American chestnuts essentially as a forest tree here in North America. So I'm sure there are listeners that don't know the relationship between biotechnology as it exists today and American chestnut. So why don't you give us some background on that?
Sure. So as I mentioned earlier, chestnuts were wiped out by a fungus imported from Asia on Asian chestnuts, and they spread through American chestnuts. And basically by the 1950s, you would not see chestnuts around on the landscape, except for little sprouts shooting up from the rootstock of killed trees. In response to this, industry kind of moved on, went to new trees, different species, but conservationists and people looking from the ecological perspective really wanted to bring back American chestnut. How can we breed chestnut trees that are resistant to this deadly fungus? So for many years now, there have been traditional tree breeding programs spearheaded by the American Chestnut Foundation, a nonprofit group. And by traditional tree breeding program, I mean that they started with a hybrid of an American chestnut and a resistant Chinese chestnut. This hybrid is resistant to the fungus. And then they back cross, so they then breed that individual back to American chestnut repeatedly to try to get a tree that has the resistance from the Chinese chestnut, but all the other characteristics of American chestnut. Now, trees, they live a long time, so this approach is really slow, and it's also filled with trial and error, because you can take many years doing this traditional breeding and only later discover that what you thought you had wasn't really resistant, or test whether something is truly resistant to the fungus. So right now, the American Chestnut Foundation has trees that are 15/16 American chestnut and 1/16 Chinese chestnut that they're testing and planting out in the field that hopefully have good resistance to chestnut blight. But again, these trees are still mixes, so they are a mix of American and chestnut, American and Chinese chestnut. Recently, a group from SUNY ESF, Dr. Powell and Dr. Maynard, have developed a genetically modified chestnut. So they took a few genes from wheat, and those genes give that chestnut, a complete American chestnut, resistance against the fungus. So in a really short period of time, relative to the other traditional tree breeding projects, they were able to make huge progress in an American chestnut tree that is resistant to chestnut blight. So this, I think, is one of the reasons why people are starting to realize the potential of biotechnology in forest restoration, in that these other traditional tree breeding programs are going to take many, many years. So you can't have a fast response to something. Of course, the genetically engineered chestnut, the American chestnut from SUNY SF, is still in testing phases, so it hasn't been approved. It's still being in a trial phase. But the same kind of thing could be done with a lot of other trees. So elms that have been killed by Dutch elm disease, as well as ash with the emerald ash borer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, what has been your experience? Have you, well, maybe you've not had direct experience on this issue, but have you had any experience with interacting with the public on this American chestnut trait, which is genetically engineered and seems to be providing a very substantial level of resistance? I mean, I can imagine that in the world of forest health, there would be a quite a wide range of acceptance of this as an option. Now it isn't being deployed as you've pointed out, but what's been your experience in terms of the public reception to this issue?
Well, I think in general, people who want to see the American chestnut brought back are environmentalists, and they care a lot about the ecology of these areas. And there are some big differences between forested systems, especially these naturally regenerating forested systems, and agricultural crops. And so I think there's some good reasons that people should be looking at risks and weighing those against potential benefits. So agricultural crops are highly managed systems. They're going to be dominated by monocultures of particular non-native plant species that have been carefully bred by humans for thousands of years. Forests, on the other hand, are going to be naturally regenerating, populated by native tree species. They need to be working together in a network. They need to be playing important ecological roles as well as economical roles. So any unintended negative consequences of GE trees to the environment might have further reaching impacts than in agricultural systems. But at the same time, the benefits are huge if we could save ash trees from the emerald ash borer, if we could bring back chestnut, which was a really important species for a lot of wildlife. So I think that the potential risks need to be weighed against those potential benefits. One of the kind of sticking points with trees for restoration is the idea that modified genes are going to escape and contaminate the native trees. And that's a tough one because that's true. That's exactly what people are hoping with American chestnut, is that the genetically modified chestnut would mix with the native chestnuts and you would have that high diversity. So you wouldn't have what we mentioned earlier, that bottlenecking effect. Mm-hmm. You would have a more diverse group of trees that are present rather than less.
And that would be because the gene or gene construct that is engineered for resistance would move about in pollen and end up in a wide variety of trees with different genetics. Is that fair to say that?
Yeah, and I think that when it comes to saving a tree that would otherwise be eliminated, that's a good thing. But I also really want to emphasize that most of the uses for biotechnology and restoration have nothing to do with genetic engineering. So there's a lot of different potential ways that biotechnology is being used that won't result in transgenic trees. So one example of that would be looking at rapid cycle breeding. So rapid cycle breeding would be in a testing phase. So we mentioned that traditional tree breeding takes a long time, and that's one of the major limitations, is that trees could take anywhere from, 5 to 7 years to reach flowering. So you really are slowed down by that. Rapid cycle breeding is the temporary changing of the tree's genome to cause it to flower earlier. So typically that's done by introducing some genes in a laboratory setting that then would create a genetically engineered tree, but just in those testing phases. And the offspring of that tree aren't genetically engineered. So you can really speed up that whole breeding process. Another way that biotechnology is being used would be with chemical fingerprinting or using molecular markers to try to identify trees that are resistant or have particular traits that you care about. So with chestnut, if we could have screened more efficiently all the trees that were going into the initial breeding programs using our present techniques to see which ones might be resistant, which ones were less likely to be resistant, that would have saved a lot of work on the front end. So now people are using chemical fingerprinting to compare resistant individuals and susceptible individuals to see if we can learn from that and use that information to restore American chestnut.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. These are good points. You've made the point that many uses of biotechnology exist that are not necessarily genetic engineering. And you gave the example of rapid cycle breeding and also molecular markers. And I want to stress for listeners that molecular markers are, you know, that whole science is a very advanced use of genetic knowledge, but it can be used and is used to help in, you know, very classical kinds of conventional breeding. And so you're saying the same is true for trees as much as it is for field crops.
So. Definitely. And one other really cool application of the biotechnology toolbox towards forest restoration that I just heard of recently is a project using RNA interference, or RNAi, to help control the emerald ash borer. So the emerald ash borer is an insect that's wiping out ash trees throughout the Midwestern and Eastern forests. Basically, I think in forests that have been affected by this, after the ash borer goes through, all of the ash trees will be gone. So RNAi is a natural process that uses, that silences or turns off genes that are potentially unwanted or harmful. So this is already existing in the plant, but through biotechnology, scientists can use that existing pathway to defend them from particular threats, like insects or viruses, and potentially breed trees without undesirable characteristics. So what's happening right now in the RNAi emerald ash borer world is that they've found that there are some RNA constructs that will be lethal to the emerald ash borer. So you could use those either as an application, a spray that could be used as a really targeted biopesticide, so it won't affect other insects, just the emerald ash borer, or you could even genetically modify ash trees to make them resistant to the emerald ash borer in that way. But I think that illustrates that genetic modification isn't the only way that biotechnology is being used. It's one of them, and it's part of that whole toolbox, but there are many other ways that forest restoration is being assisted by our new molecular techniques.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. Yeah, I think it's you've made that point very well, and I'm glad for that. So, you know, just as a plant pathologist, I see rather substantial threats, to forests and other agroecosystems from invasive pathogens or infectious agents, as well as invasive insect pests. And I know you're aware of this. And there's quite a list. The woolly hemlock adelgid. You worked with sudden oak death in California. And, there's just, I think it's a little bit cynical, but also realistic to worry about the, or pessimistic, maybe not cynical, but pessimistic, to worry about the pace of the introduction of invasive organisms. It's my perspective or bias, if you want to call it that, is that I think that genetic tools of all sorts are going to have to be part of the future if we're going to, defend our forests against the many invasive threats that exist or probably will continue, because there's so much plant movement throughout the world. And globalization has had many benefits, but it's also been a good way to move around unwanted organisms. So anyway, what do you think about all that? What's your thoughts about invasive pests in general and insects and so on?
I don't think you're being pessimistic. I think you're being realistic. Invasive species are only going to increase with increased global movement. And as we have a changing climate, there's going to be invasive threats to these trees, other stressors. Mm-hmm. So they are increasingly under stress. And so we're going to need better tools to deal with that. One of the things we haven't talked about yet are invasive plants. So while those aren't directly infecting or damaging the tree, they are a serious threat to a lot of our forested areas. So they can prevent regeneration of new species, native species, prevent seedlings from being able to come up and grow. And hopefully we can turn to the genetic toolbox again for some new management approaches for invasive plant species. Because what we're doing right now, trying to control them with herbicide, that's really not a long-term sustainable solution. Once something arrives, you can eradicate it or try to keep it from getting here. But once an invasive plant is established, it is really challenging to manage it at a regional level. And so one of the options that's been suggested to manage invasive plants that hasn't been tried yet would be using a gene drive approach to introduce something negative into these invasive plants to kind of reduce their competitive ability compared to some of our native species. So gene drive, for anyone who's not familiar, is adding some negative genes that are then kind of propagate themselves more than a gene normally would. So it will create a homozygous copy of itself in that genome and be passed down to future generations at a much higher level than a gene normally would. So could we use a gene drive technology to push through something that would make, say, bush honeysuckle less competitive? It's a possibility. Again, you know, there are a lot of questions related to this, but we're definitely looking for better solutions than what we currently have.
Yeah, gene drives. Thanks for bringing that up. And gene drives, just for those of you who are new to that phrase, that is quite distinct from engineering plants for better plant health, for example, pest resistance or disease resistance, and so on. Gene drives are quite different, and they're meant to propagate and cause some degree of harm to the organism that's been engineered. So that I just want to make sure everyone is clear on the distinction between those two. And gene drives have quite a bit of a controversy surrounding their use. So you know, and so we'll continue to follow that debate, and maybe even have somebody come and speak to us about gene drives in our Talking Biotech.
Oh, I love that! I'd love to hear more about that.
What a good idea! I'm going to make a note. So yeah, gene drives. All right, so we'll put that in the list. I like the way you've used the phrase genetic toolbox. I want to highlight that. That's a great phrase. And is there anything else you'd like listeners to know before we close the interview?
I think that there are many threats facing our forests, and we need to be looking everywhere for potential solutions. Not that we need to take all of them. So there's a lot of research being done that uses biotechnology, and we need to, as a society, figure out what are our priorities and how do we want to solve some of these problems. So do we want to just leave things the way that they are and accept that we're going to be losing a lot of these tree species, the benefits that they give us, as well as the environment? Or do we want to take a more proactive approach? And if so, what will that be? So fortunately, we are getting an increasing number of different ways to potentially deal with some of these threats. But we need to decide together how we're going to pursue that.
Yeah. Yeah, good conversation and public engagement, not not lecturing, which is our tendency as scientists, or my tendency as a scientist, but to engage the public. So I think you've hit on a very good point. If they want to know more about your work, where would you send listeners?
You can go to foresthealthcenter.org. You'll find information about our center and the different researchers that are there. We try to kind of produce summaries of some of the research projects that are in language that'll be easily understandable. I know sometimes their scientific papers are less intelligible, so hopefully that'll be a good resource for anyone who wants to learn more.
Great. Well, Ellen, it's been a pleasure to interview you. I enjoyed working with you, and we'll carry on with our work together. I appreciate you joining us on the program.
Great. Thanks for having me on, Paul.
And thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Talking Biotech. Write a review on iTunes and tell a friend to listen, as your support allows us to deliver more about exciting science to more people. I'm Paul Vincelli, and thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Please send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review on iTunes and recommend this podcast to a friend. More downloads and reviews raise the visibility of this podcast and help us reach a wider audience with science.